Scatimi v. Holder, Mr. Hoppeck.
May it please the Court, my name is Matthew Hoppeck, and I'm here representing the petitioners, a family of Kenyan citizens, Francis Scatimi, Jane Scatimi, and Colin Scatimi. There are several issues for review before the Court. This is an appeal of the denial of an appeal before the Board of Immigration Appeals, and also the appeal of a denial of a motion to remand before the Board of Immigration Appeals. The first issue is, in my opinion, the motion to remand. While the appeal was pending, violence broke out in Kenya that the petitioners believed gave them a new basis for asylum before the Immigration Court, and thus they properly filed a motion to remand with the Board of Immigration Appeals.
But, Mr. Hoppeck, does this Court, under the jurisprudence we've developed, have jurisdiction over the motion to remand? Because I have to say, it looks like a factual determination about how much of a change has happened in Kenya. And our view has been very strictly to say that we don't review those kinds of things.
This Court has identified two exceptions, where there's an issue of law and where there's a constitutional question with the review.
Okay. And can you identify any? I mean, certainly the government argues that there is no such thing.
I can. There's a line of cases from this Court that says when the board or the immigration judge simply doesn't consider the evidence or doesn't consider arguments that would be meritorious to the petitioner, that that's not an exercise of discretion, but that in the Sosnovskaya case, this Court called that an affront to her right to be heard. And that's what the petitioners would be arguing, that there were pieces of evidence for the motion to remand that said there was violence in the Rift Valley, and there was pieces of evidence that said there was violence in Nairobi. What the board did was they cited the Rift Valley evidence and said, oh, you don't live in the Rift Valley, so we're not going to remand. The error, and the legal error, the petitioners would argue, is that they don't cite any evidence that talks about violence in Nairobi. And that's the evidence that we cited in our initial brief.
But why isn't that at most a mistake of fact on the assessment of changed country conditions?
It's an affront to their right to be heard.
Well, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to rights to be heard and everything, but if you start saying that the right to be heard means that we have to have every piece of evidence discussed in the board's opinion, that would be contrary to the law that we've developed. And then so they say, well, maybe not every piece, but like the big pieces. And it's tough to see how this doesn't fall within the general rubric of a factual determination, which may be mistaken. It's always the ones that may be mistaken that are the most difficult to deal with. But if there's no jurisdiction, there's no jurisdiction.
The answer to your question is there should at least be some citation to the evidence that would have been meritorious to the petitioners. When the board doesn't even talk about that evidence, doesn't mention the evidence, there's not enough record for this court to review whether the board did in fact abide by its burden to consider the evidence, or it didn't.
Do you happen to know how far apart the Rift Valley area is from Nairobi in Kenya?
I know they're somewhat close. I know that they're not on opposite sides of the country. I couldn't describe them to you geographically, though. This whole region of Kenya, including the region of Eldoret, I think we spoke about a small town in the Rift Valley. It's all very close to each other, and that gets me to the case that we cited in our brief, the Tikwalu case that's from the First Circuit, where the board, the First Circuit held that the board had erred by holding that the violence in that country was too far removed from his home place. And the First Circuit said, right, if we can see violence, considering that it's too far removed, it isn't really enough, that it should be remanded to the immigration judge for fact-finding.
What I would be helped by is if you went back to your primary petition for review, forget about the motion to
sure
remand, and explain what you think your strongest argument is, or the strongest evidence that the Mungiki are a social group, as that term is used. I understand you to be saying that the government is acquiescing in their acts of violence, and I also understood you to be making an argument that you didn't have to, you know, wear a T-shirt that said, I'm a member of the Mungiki, you know, in order to be seen as a social group in the country, that there could be, as I think of it, social groups that can be ascertained by talking to somebody, and then social groups that may be more physically visible as social groups.
If I may take a step back, the social group we've tried to identify as former members of the Mungiki,
okay,
and
yeah, sure,
there's an immutable characteristic in that you're a former member, which would be similar to the Sepulveda case that this court decided, which was that as long as you're a former member, you can never resign from that group of former memberships. That would be an immutable characteristic, like the Acosta case the BIA said was one of the factors. Now, since Acosta, the BIA has identified multiple factors that a social group could have, but has never considered social visibility as a necessary condition, but rather a sufficient condition for establishing a social group. Here, I think it's important to read the close language of matter of CA, matter of AME and JGU, and matter of AT. In each case, the board doesn't apply this requirement of social visibility to general society, but they say, one, that it's a sufficient condition, not a necessary condition, but second, as long as you're visible to the persecutor, that was enough. That the board used that language in all three of these cases, that the group was visible to the persecutor, and thus they would be a particular social group. The Attorney General is asking you to apply a standard that if you're not visible to general society, as you've said, if you're not wearing the T-shirt, that you're not a particular social group. And I think our best argument is that you would look at the past cases of particular social group, specifically matter of Kasinga and matter of Toboso Alfonso. In both cases, the board identified a particular social group that general society couldn't see. In matter of Kasinga, it was female members of the Kunta tribe who had not undergone FGM. And our argument before the court would be general society can't see who has undergone female genital mutilation. The second is Toboso Alfonso, which was a group of people who were on the government's list of those who might be homosexual. And again, when you're walking down the street, general society doesn't see you as a member of that particular social group.
So how would you define the social group here?
In this instance, we would define it as anyone who used to be a member of the Mungiki and has left. Because the Mungiki, and the evidence before the court was clear, that the Mungiki persecutes anyone who leaves, threatens to kill them, threatens to force their spouses and their female family members to undergo FGM.
So I take it they're, in a sense, kind of like the Taliban, in that they have notions of purity and the like that they wish to impose on their members.
That's right.
Including female circumcision or whatever.
That's right. And there's an additional...
And you have to also say that the government is doing nothing about it, because if the Mungiki are doing this, maybe they're just thugs, but...
That's right.
We have to get the government involved somehow.
On the point of whether the government acquiesces, the immigration judge held that the government, because they've banned the Mungiki, they've done their part. And the evidence in the record that the petitioners brought was that no matter the ban, they haven't stopped it and they can't stop it. This is where the motion to remand also comes into play, because the evidence... In support of the motion to remand, said that in December of 2007, January of 2008, the government had actually hired the Mungiki to do its dirty work and had promised future immunity for all of their past crimes as long as they would commit that violence.
Let's assume you lose on the motion to remand. What do you have in the record to show that there is sufficient government involvement, as that phrase is used in immigration law, to win your case today?
We would argue it doesn't have to be government involvement. It would have to be at least government acquiescence.
I understand that, but what do you have to show then?
The fact that the Mungiki hadn't been stopped, even though the government had banned them, I think was evidence that the government couldn't control them. The immigration judge in this...
Did he make complaints to the police? I mean, do you have particularized evidence about your client's case?
That's right. There was testimony in the record that he had complained to the police several times and they wouldn't help him. Jane Gattini had come to the United States because she was afraid. Once he finally complained to the police and they said, we will help you, that's when Jane Gattini came back to Kenya. But eventually, the police could not help him. There was testimony in the record that the Mungiki invaded their home twice, that they burned up their cars, killed all the pets, and were trying to kill Francis and Jane Gattini. That's, I think, enough evidence that the government is unable to control them.
So after reassurance, they returned to the country, and they were subjected to this again.
That's right. Jane had come to the United States after an assurance that the police in Nairobi would start to protect them. She came back to Kenya. But it was a mere week or 2 weeks after she got back that she received another threat. You're going to have to undergo FGM or there's no condition. You'll have to do it. And it's at that point that she again came back to the United States and has been here since.
What about the fact that the wife never filed her own petition for asylum?
This is an interesting issue before the court, because I don't find any precedential case law or regulations that say that a writer on an asylum application can't present her own well-founded fear to the immigration court. Now, Jane...
Apparently there is no regulation on this?
There's no regulation that says she can, or not the one that I've found. And
so
I did cite in my
reply...
So
family standing before the court thinking they were presenting everything through the father.
All of a sudden,
your view is this was pulled on.
That's our argument, because she did testify to the court that I fear if I go back, I will have to undergo FGM. And I've cited in my reply brief, I think, some things that are at least illuminative, that in previous cases before this court and in some regulations where we've considered writers on an asylum application to be an asylum applicant for the courts and the board's determination of whether they have a well-founded fear. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Ms. Rice?
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Jocelyn Wright. I'm here on behalf of Respondent, the United States Attorney General. I think the issue regarding the motion to remand has been sufficiently briefed, and so in the limited time that I have, I'd like to focus mainly on the asylum and withholding of removal claims brought by this family. With respect to...
A little louder.
Certainly, Your Honor, I apologize. With respect to your question, Judge Ripple, regarding whether or not Mrs. Gatimi could have advanced her own asylum claim, the answer is yes, she could have. It would have been time barred. However, there was nothing preventing her from filing her own separate withholding of removal claim at any time.
But just because she could have done it, I don't know why that is the sole route available to her when she's already involved in proceedings. And I have to say, I find the immigration judge's treatment of her claim almost incomprehensible. It consumes five lines of his opinion. He says, I don't find that as toward country conditions, that is, it has an objective basis, period. That's it. I mean, there's really nothing else there. And I'm just not convinced without a clear regulation saying any derivative applicant must separately file why she can't bring up her own points.
Your Honor, because of her status as a derivative applicant, and
there's
no regulation.
But where does it say that? Where
there's
does
no
it
regulation
say derivative applicants may not testify as to their own well-founded fears of persecution?
Oh, there's nothing that says that, because they can testify
in
support of the primary applicant.
And so it's part of the family's case that this is something that may happen.
But a family can't advance a family claim. Otherwise, the statutory bar, the timeliness bar in the statute would be rendered a nullity. It would be mere supplessage, because anyone then could then say, our family should be entitled
not
to asylum as a whole.
Only if you've been named as a derivative applicant. You can't just kind of stroll in and say, I'm part of the family. But what if you've been in proceedings all this time?
There may be no regulation, but the statute itself at 8 U.S.C. section 1158A3 specifically says a spouse or child of an alien who is granted asylum under the subsection may, if not otherwise eligible for asylum under this section, which to me indicates that if you have an asylum claim, you have an obligation to advance it yourself.
To me, it
sounds
like broadening.
Was the immigration judge wrong to discuss the merits of her fear about circumcision?
He may have been wrong, or certainly it was well within his...
Well, in your view, he shouldn't have said anything about the merits. Isn't that correct?
Well, in our view, the Board of Immigration Appeals issued its own decision, and so the immigration judge's legal rulings really aren't before the court.
I don't understand you. I asked a simple question. Isn't it your view that the judge should not have discussed her personal concerns since she's just a derivative applicant? Isn't it your view? He was wrong to do that?
Well, not necessarily.
He could not have given her relief?
He could not have given her relief as the primary applicant. But her whether or not she was persecuted or whether she has any fear is certainly relevant to the extent that it corroborates the primary applicant, his claim for asylum.
Is the claim really, as a practical matter, preserved anyway? Can't it be part of the husband's case that he fears if he brings his family home, his wife will be tortured?
It can be, and I think that's how the board looked at it. The board said the only application before us is the male applicant, Mr. Gatimi. And so to the extent...
But it's a legitimate argument for him to make.
I'm sorry, what argument, Your Honor? Just to
that
be clear.
That if he goes home, brings his family with him, goes home, that his wife will be tortured. That can be part of his argument. That's a
that
legitimate
he fears,
crime.
Yes, that he fears his wife will be subject to FGM. And that's how the board, I think, analyzed the claim, is from... Because they have jurisdiction.
You lose your case because, as Judge Wood pointed out, the immigration judge's discussion of the issue is incoherent.
Well, no, but the board, like I said, the board issued its own decision, and so any errors by the immigration judge would be nullified because it's the board's decision that is before
the
court.
But the board ignores it, and so if you've conceded that it's relevant, that's a gaping hole in the board's decision. And I'm also concerned about this new theory the government seems to be advancing, that social groups have to be publicly ascertainable, since, as your opponent points out, there are many social groups that immigration cases have recognized in the past that, whether it's women who've suffered FGM or Christians in China who don't look any different from anybody else in China, these people are ascertainable, but they aren't people that society as a whole is going to spot across a room. I think it's a very strange theory of social group. Families have been recognized as social groups or extended families.
What the board did here, Your Honor, and I understand that there have been previous cases where social visibility didn't play a role. However, under the board has a continuing obligation to revisit and make sure that the wisdom of its policy decisions is
So the Soviet Union persecuted people who came from bourgeois or aristocratic backgrounds. So would that be an example of social group persecution or not?
Under this circuit's jurisprudence, I think it can be, because this court has held...
How about under what the board said in this case? That's, I think, the question.
Well, I can't speak for the board, because I don't think the board has decided it with respect to social visibility, and that's the only issue that's before the court with respect to the particular social group claim in this case. Immutability isn't at issue.
Well, I don't know. What's your answer to my question?
The answer to your question, Your Honor, I said was, in that case, I think it would be immutability that would be a factor.
It would be. I can't hear you, by the way.
It would be immutability that would be the determinative factor in your hypothetical, as far as I understand. I'm not sure I understand how social visibility.
Well, yes, we know being a former member of a group is an immutable status, also. So immutability is not distinguishing. So what do you think of my case? These people who were the scions of bourgeois and so on, they didn't look any different, presumably, from other people, but it was known, who their parents were and so forth, or it could be determined from their birth certificate. So would that be an immutable, would that be a social group?
Again, I don't know, Your Honor.
So is it socially visible? That's the question. The board has this idea in this case that there's a requisite social visibility to establishing that one is a member of a particular social group. And they cite this matter of CA. And so then they actually go again. They say socially visible group. So bearing that in mind, under this decision of the board's, how do you answer Judge Posner's question?
What the board was doing with respect to social visibility was that it was fleshing out
what
particular...
Well, is it a yes or no answer? How about that?
As I've already told Judge Posner, I simply don't know whether or not that would be a social group, Your Honor.
Well, because you've agreed that a socially visible group might be invisible?
Because social visibility is not a prerequisite, necessarily.
But the board
it's a relevant
seems to say
factor.
It is.
Well, the board
Why
says it's
it
a relevant that? Factor. It's relevant because the board, in trying to refine what particular social group means, and it's ambiguous, it's statutorily ambiguous, and so the board is authorized
Why
certainly
is
to
it
flesh
relevant?
It out.
What does it have to do with
it's relevant
what does visibility
because
have to do with anything?
In this case, the board said...
Not in this case. What does visibility have to do with anything connected with the statute?
I think what the board was trying to do was to liken particular social group with the other accompanying protected grounds. What did the other
well,
protected grounds...
Well, that doesn't work either,
Well, what
actually.
Did the other protected grounds have in common? Political opinion, religion, nationality, ethnicity.
But religious people who belong to a religion which is persecuted, like Jehovah's Witnesses in Eritrea, they conceal their religion. They're not visible. Anyway, people of a religion... Some people might wear religious jewelry or something. Most usually can't determine a person's religion just by looking at the person, right?
No, in some instances
so
you can.
Why do you say social visibility would help to connect social groups with the other statutory categories of asylum eligibles?
Because I think the board, and it relelied on the UNHCR's guidelines regarding particular social group as well, and both of those sources specifically say that a group must exist. It must be discrete and recognizable to the society before you can make it a social group for purposes of the asylum statute, because otherwise you're defining what a particular social group is by the very fact that they have been persecuted. And that's circular reasoning, which
What's wrong with that? I don't understand.
Well, there may be nothing wrong with it, but the board is...
a group of people who are being persecuted because they belong to that group, why doesn't that make them members of a social group who can complain about persecution?
I think that might be okay, except that what the board and the UNHCR was trying to fight off in this and using social visibility as a relevant factor is to define the group
what
by virtue
the
of the persecution.
What is it you're worried about? Give me an example of a case where, without visibility, somehow ineligible people would be able to argue that they were members of a social group.
Without visibility, Your Honor, or with visibility?
Yes. Yeah. What's your example of an invisible group, like defectors from the Mungiki, who would present an abuse of the asylum statute because of their invisibility? What are you worried about?
I mean, and the board has, this case, the former Mungikis, as well as the informants in CA and AME, in CA and I forget the other case, but drug informants, who basically are defining the group. It's not like a class action where you define the class by virtue of the harm that they've suffered, and that's basically what he's doing here. The Mungiki is a secretive sect. And so to the extent that you can say there's a social group in Kenya of former Mungikis, that's not accurate because there is no socially recognized group of former Mungikis. No one can walk down the street, and the record evidence here
that certainly does sound circular to me, because if they know what the Mungiki are and they know you used to be in the Mungiki, and now you're one of these people at risk of being persecuted by them, it seems to me that's perfectly well defined. You'd have to talk to somebody before you found out whether he or she was in that group, but I don't know that the law says you can't talk to people.
Because, again, here he's arguing that the social group of former Mungikis would not necessarily exist but for the fact that the Mungikis are looking for them. The general society doesn't recognize a social group of former Mungikis. Nothing would happen to them even if they did recognize them. That's what the board is using here as a relevant factor.
How does this connect with anything in the statute?
Because the board is trying to refine what particular social group means. It is within its authority to flesh it out. And I understand that earlier cases don't use social visibility, but after Brand X, this court has to revisit this particular social group jurisprudence in the circuit, given the board's later decisions, more recent decisions in CA, AME, and JGU, and SEG, and its pronouncements regarding what relevant factors should be considered in taking into account and defining what constitutes a particular social group. And I see that my time has expired, unless the court has any further
thank
questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. So,
thank
Mr. Hapak, how much does he have? 1 minute?
I wanted to briefly address Judge Posner's question about why visibility even matters here, where we're getting it, why is it, because it's not in the Act. And the answer is, in matter of CA, the board found this standard in the 2002 UNHCR guidelines. It's helpful to read those because we can read essentially what the UNHCR meant. In matter of CA at page 956, the board said, a group of persons who share a common characteristic other than the risk of being persecuted or are perceived as a group by society. And so the board was essentially using the standard from the UNHCR, but the UNHCR guidelines don't make it a necessary condition, but a sufficient condition when you don't have immutability. Here we've had the Attorney General has conceded that this is an immutable group, and thus it's not clear why their visibility really even matters. The second issue...
Well, what about her example of the drug informers? Would they be a social group?
It's not clear to me, but in that specific case, the board said they're not a social group because they're not visible to the persecutor. And so the Cali cartel wouldn't even know who the informants were, and so why are you a social group? Here, there's evidence in the record that they are visible to the Mungiki because the Mungiki has come to their house twice, burned all their vehicles, killed family pets, has arrested Francis Mungiki, Francis Katimi, and tried to persecute him. So... I'm not sure a direct answer to your question.
Informers, it seems, because the, I guess the difference is the drug the drug informers, I mean, are they defectors from a social group forming their own derivative social group? It does begin to seem pretty vague.
I guess it depends on what they were doing.
Anybody who's persecuted for any reason, couldn't he say, I'm a member of the social group of people who are persecuted for the same reason?
You're right. I think it depends on what the informants were doing in the first place. I think the line is drawn by Acosta. If there's an immutable characteristic that they either can't change or shouldn't have to change.
The immutable characteristic, that applies to all the informers. To all former members of a group, are their status as a former member is immutable. Right.
There are other factors that the board has addressed. In addition, voluntary associational relationship. The board has said drug informants don't get together. They don't know each other. They don't know who each other are.
Does this have to do with how well the Mungiki themselves are organized and described? They certainly are a social group, I would say
they are a social group.
So maybe it has something to do with the group that you're opposing. If it doesn't happen to be a traditional thing, like, you know, I'm a member of the Elk Club or something, you know.
I think that would be a permissible argument, that if you're a former member of something that's identifiable as a social group, you're in a social group. And that would be the Sepulveda language. If you're an employee of the Attorney General in Colombia, you're probably a member in a particular social group. If all employees by the Attorney General are persecuted, once you are no longer an employee of the Attorney General in Colombia, you're now in a social group of former members, and that would be a similar
traitors
case to this one.
Yes.
Of course, they were working together. They were in the same office, so the group is a little better defined, I suppose, than all drug informers. But it does seem a little hazy, doesn't it?
You're right, and in matter of CA, the court did say that drug informants aren't a particular social group, but there were other factors in that case. For instance, they didn't know each other. They had no associational relationship, and they weren't visible to the persecutor. And I think that's a really key language. In each CA, matter of AT, and matter of AME and JGU, in each case, the board considered whether you're visible to the persecutor. And
why
here,
is that important?
Because
that's
if the persecutor
about social group, that's important about whether you're at risk, right?
Well, another section of the UNHCR guidelines are helpful. After the section that the Attorney General cites in their brief, that you can't be defined just by your persecution, the sentence goes on to say, persecutory action toward a group may be a relevant factor in determining the visibility of a group in a particular society. That's matter of CA at page 960. So I think it is a relevant factor determining whether you're a social group if you're being targeted for persecution, if the persecutor could find you.
Okay, well, thank you very much,
Mr.
Hoppeck and Ms. Wright. And the court will be in recess until tomorrow.